Hi everyone, and welcome to this buy one, get one free extra special episode of the UKIS ITEL podcast. And in this episode, we have a recording of a recent unlocked event that I did with Minister of State for Security, Tom Tugendhat. Tom and I met in late April and talked, amongst other things, about the threat that Russia poses to us, about the UK's role in European defence, and about China's increased assertiveness on the world stage. I'm pretty sure you're going to find it really interesting. Hope you enjoy it. See you again soon. Take care. Bye. This is, for those of you who don't know, we had a series during the Brexit years called Beer and Brexit. This is basically a rebranded version of that. And we hope to sort of have a regular series once a month of these in conversation events where we can spend an hour talking to a well-known politician, not engage in sort of punch and Judy fisticuffs, but actually find out what they think about some of the big issues. The next one actually is going to be of very little use to you lot in the sense that it's going to be in Leeds, unless you're very, very keen and you want to come up to Leeds, but it's going to be streamed. It's with the Mayor of West Yorkshire, and it's a series we will, as I said, keep trying to keep going with the sort of monthly routine from here on in. Without further ado, let me welcome Tom Tugendhat here. We always like to start off with some facts you might not have known. His surname means has virtue in German, apparently. I won't quiz you about that. He's got a master's degree in Islamic studies and speaks Arabic. Blimey.
Badly.
Were you going to show off some Arabic there?
No, I've forgotten so much.
Right. He rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel in the Territorial Army, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, a citizen of both Britain and France. Constituency is Tunbridge and Malling. And he is the Minister of State for Security and is the sixth such minister since 2019. Tom, welcome. Unlike many in contemporary politics, you didn't go straight into politics. You're not what they call a career politician. I've never known what that meant. How did you find politics when you went into it? Did it surprise you? Were you pleasantly surprised?
Yeah, it was. It was surprising. It's a really strange job,
yeah.
In the sense it's not really a job, it's a lifestyle in the way that many careers are.
Well, I'm an academic, you don't have to tell me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yours is a lifestyle.
Yeah.
I'll stop there. I was about to make a joke, but I'll save it okay. For another time. I got into politics through soldiering, but mostly because you get to see a slice of your country that you don't always see when you're soldiering. You meet people from across the United Kingdom, you meet people, in fact, across the Commonwealth, who come from very different backgrounds, and you see different ways of approaching life and people, you know, getting into and out of trouble in different ways. And I got into politics, you know, looking to help people like that, people like me, people like, you know, with different backgrounds or whatever, who, you know, needed different opportunities. And getting into politics from that is, I mean, it's interesting because much of it is similar in the sense it's a service ethos and it's a full commitment. You can't do it 9 to 5. But much of it's very different, and the bits that are different are the personal hostility is different.
Yeah.
The publicity, the fact that your face is known is different. And of course, you know, one of the great things about a uniform is you do genuinely disappear. You know, people who know you as a soldier will only recognize you as a soldier, and people who know you as a civvy will only recognize you as a civvy. So you sort of blend in, as it were, even without trying to, whereas in politics, you're permanently exposed.
And particularly, I suppose, given the induction into politics that you've had, because the last few years of politics have been,
it's been so
crazy,
stable,
haven't they? I mean, looking back, I mean, this is an awful question, so I always feel bad asking. I mean, looking back at the last sort of 7 or 8 years of our politics, what have you made of it? And do you think we're safely out of the other end of it?
I mean, you don't need me to tell you. I mean, you've been writing about it. It's been pretty chaotic. Mm. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's been pretty chaotic. But what we've seen really is the effects of a revolution. And it's, you know, people talk about different revolutionary moments in UK life. I think the last 8 years have been revolutionary, and partly it's due to choices people have made, and partly it's due to the fact that technology has changed radically. And whenever you have a big change in technology, you have revolutions. And you know, one of the big changes in technology was printing. That led to 200 years of revolutions in Europe. Then we had, you know, cables and globalization is another revolution. Now we've had the internet is another revolution, you know, and the way that people interact has been revolutionary, and it's changed the legitimacy of organizations and institutions. It's changed the way political life is conducted, and it's led to the kind of revolutions that we've been seeing in the UK and various choices that we've followed on from it.
I remember at one of our events, Sam Coates saying that the WhatsApp screenshot is going to be seen in hindsight as the thing that has changed politics most, because it's allowed journalists to sort of trade in gossip so much more easily and with sort of evidence than
It's interesting, isn't it? It's one of the things you've written so much about history in the past and politics in the past, that you know, when you read old biographies or histories or whatever, people are trading off the notes in the margins of papers or the whatever it is. You know, they don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know whether, I mean, I get what Sam's talking about, but I don't know whether we're going to see this as a new Dark Ages, because actually, not that things won't have happened, but you'll only see the final result. You won't see the iteration. You won't see the conversation. Yeah. There's no letter. You know, I haven't written a letter to folk about various things. You write formal letters, sure, you know, but they are very structured, very formulaic. You don't have the sort of, you know, the gossipy letters that people used to write and keep.
Yeah. The sort of Churchill letters and things.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that. Yeah. Have there been moments when you've regretted going into politics?
Yeah, most mornings. Yeah. it's not always fun. It's got a lot of downsides, and it's not just me who's paying them. My wife pays them very heavily, and my kids pay them a bit. They're very young at the moment, so how much I stay will depend on how much they continue paying them. And, you know, with a weird surname like mine, other members of my extended family pay it as well, and I'm very conscious of that, that, you know, they can't disappear, right? I mean, it's not, you know, I may not be virtuous, but the name does have, you know, it sticks, right?
Yeah.
And you can't hide, and others can't hide us. So that does have downsides. But then, you know, it is a huge privilege to serve your country. I mean, it is a huge privilege to try and do the best for a community. And, you know, Tunbridge and Morling is an amazing place, and I'm lucky to represent some fantastic people, and I'm sure 649 of my colleagues would say exactly the same thing about their areas. And it's, you know, and it's great to be able to have an opportunity to spread and challenge ideas, to, you know, to champion thoughts and to try and change your country for the better. I mean, I think that's, you know, that is a huge privilege.
We will come on to your current brief and spend most of our time on that, but before we do, I mean, there's a lot of talk around at the moment. There was a Stephen Bush piece in the FT this morning about the lack of political vision around. And he was arguing there's a lack of political vision on both sides, both Labour and the Conservatives. If you can sum it up, what is your vision about what conservatism could and should be? And are there things that perhaps aren't being focused on that you'd like to see people spending more time on now?
So, I think Stephen writes very interestingly about many things, and I found his piece this morning challenging, and I think, you know, one of the great things about his tradition is he's not particularly from my political tradition. I mean, he's not tribal, but he certainly comes more from the left of the argument than the right, is that he does raise that challenge. And I think it's a fair one, because I think asking people to vote is not actually asking people to vote for 1% up or 1% down, or, you know, one more bed or one less bed or whatever. It's asking people to vote for you when things don't go right. It's asking you, you know, people are trusting you to make decisions that they can't predict. The decisions they can predict, you know, that's relatively easy. It's the ones that you can't.
Yeah.
And the nature of our political life is that, you know, you vote for somebody and 3 or 4 years later something happens, or indeed, you know, with COVID, what was it, you know, 3 months later, something world-changing happened. And you need to know, not that they will, you know, do exactly what you asked, but they will approach the challenge in the way that you would at least sympathize with, if not mm-hmm. always agree. And so I think the vision thing does matter. I mean, I think it matters, and I think that's why the challenge is important. Not because, you know, I want Britain to be the number one, you know, basketball country in the next 5 years. That's not the vision. The vision is, what does society look like? Why do you affiliate with these ideas and not those? And I think for me, you know, the reason I'm a conservative is because I think it's very easy if you're an American tech entrepreneur to move fast and break things.
Yeah.
If you're responsible for a community or for a platoon, then you've got to think about the most vulnerable in your society and you've got to think about how that community works. But you've also got to remember that if you want to have resilience and innovation and ideas and change and challenge, that only works if you've got a dynamic within the community that prizes the individual, that doesn't treat people as a block or a group, but recognizing that an individual, a family, a community have their own dynamic and their own ability mm-hmm. to innovate and to come up with ideas. And so that challenge of responsibility with individualism is, I think, for me, the fundamental of conservatism. And I think that's where, you know, any good conservative government has constantly got to be asking itself, how do I trust people more? How do I make sure people are more in charge of their own lives, as it were? How do I give people the ability to determine their own future? But at the same time, how do I make sure that the safety net is there for those mm-hmm. for whom, for one reason or another, the choices aren't available or the result would be disastrous?
So there is such a thing as society?
Yes, there is. But it's not the same thing as the state. And that's the important difference. There is absolutely such thing as society, and we live it. I mean, you know, a university is a society, a family is a society, a church, a football club, I mean, a pub. You know, there are many different ways in which we all interact with society. Mm. The state is something different. Now, the state is, you know, has a place, right? I mean, you know, I was a soldier. I mean, I've always, in some way or another, had a very strong connection to the state. Mm. You know, and the state really does have a role in protecting, in removing as much risk as possible, and enabling people to flourish. But the purpose of the state is not to command, but to serve. And the purpose of society is to provide the softer side of life, if you like, to provide that support that an individual can't do alone.
Okay. So moving on, I've got to ask you this because I'm quite into the sort of ins and outs of this. What is the biggest difference between being a minister and being a backbench MP? I mean,
freedom.
Promoted. Is it a fundamental change?
Yes, fundamental.
In what way?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's...
Apart from the car.
What car? I get the bus. I have a big red ministerial car with 70 other people in it. The big difference is, you know the old line, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Will you oppose your own government in hard rock? You know, you've really got to shout at and beat it. And chairing the Foreign Affairs Committee and, you know, being a backbench MP, if you wanted to get change, you really had to make a lot of noise. And the difference being a minister is, look, you lose that freedom. Yeah, you do. And, you know, that's part of the deal because you can't have the government opposing itself. But you do...
Do we have that?
It doesn't make for a good result. No. The country doesn't benefit. Mm. You know, a few egos may be served, but the country doesn't benefit. But the quid pro quo is you get your hands on some of those levers, not all of them, and maybe there's not as many as you'd like, but you get the ability to actually make a difference. And so, you know, we have some pretty robust discussions. And actually, one of the things that I've been most impressed by, actually, with colleagues, many of whom I, you know, some of whom I don't agree with on everything. I mean, that's not exactly surprising. But I've had some pretty robust conversations with many people in government that have not emerged anywhere, which shows that, you know, communities can work together, governments can work together, we can have pretty robust debates, and, you know, those that need to be kept private are kept private.
And collective responsibility is a thing.
Yeah, it does. It counts.
I've never been entirely certain about the role of security minister and how it interacts with the role of national security advisor. Can you sort of clarify?
Yeah, we're the only ones, well, not the only ones, but we're one of the few countries to have it. It's It's interesting. It's evolved. It started off as being a pure Home Office function, as you can imagine, and very, very much focused on terror, basically. Yeah. And it was, you know, very much focused on making sure that the counter-terror apparatus the Home Office was delivering. And it's evolved. And it's evolved because the nature of security has changed. You know, you've spoken about it in the past, cybersecurity. You know, I think you can frankly drop the word cyber. It's just security now because it's so all-encompassing. And many other different aspects, including personal security. So fraud is something that I'm very focused on. You know, a huge elements of the job. And now, you know, as a father of two young children, you'll understand that security of the home, child sexual exploitation, is something that takes a huge amount of my time that I take very personally. And the role of the NSA is different. The role of the NSA is to advise the Prime Minister, very specifically. And Tim Barrow and I work extremely closely together. I think he's an extremely impressive public servant. I think he's done amazing things for our country over many, many years, not least as ambassador in Moscow and as our representative in Brussels. You know, he's done fantastic work for us. But his role is very much focused on making sure the Prime Minister is ready, making sure Prime Minister's advice is ready. My job is slightly different. It's ministerial, so it's to take various decisions on how we run different aspects of our security apparatus and infrastructure.
Where does security end? I mean, it's very easy nowadays, isn't it, to talk about environmental security, economic security, human security.
And that's right, it's all me.
Yeah, but is it delineated?
I mean, you know, the nature of government is like life. I mean, there aren't hard and fast borders between anything. So I do work a lot with colleagues, obviously, you know, and finding ways in which you can make sure that you're doing what I think is really important, which is championing individual liberty, but also defending the ability of people to start, you know, to set out their own lives is tricky. And that's where things like energy security, you know, are incredibly important, but not all of it's with me. You know, Grant Shapps does energy security and net zero. But a lot of, you know, there's a lot of cooperation. And then there's, you know, anything from, you know, transport. Well, maritime trade is clearly part of the Department for Trade and Department for Transport. But actually maritime security, you know, there's overlaps there too. So it's, you're constantly looking at where you add value and where you can help. And it's very easy in any large organization to sort of double up.
Yeah.
And so what you've got to be careful about doing is making sure you're adding, you're not just crowding out.
And I suppose one of the dangers, as soon as you start referring to something as a security issue, you talk about it differently, the processes might be slightly different, and there's a danger sometimes, isn't there, that governments reach for the security switch because it makes it slightly easier to take faster decisions. And you just sort of...
Yeah, I wish. yeah, I mean, I think the way people talk about security reflects the way they think about their role. So I don't think that security is about closing things down. I don't think it's about locks and keys. I think it's about opening things up. I mean, the greatest security successes of our country have been reflected in things like the Queen's funeral only a few months ago, where you saw quite literally thousands of people on the streets of London. And I hope you didn't feel in any way that it was a hostile environment. I hope you didn't feel that it was a, you know, police, particularly heavily policed environment. It certainly didn't look like it to me, but I may be a bit biased on that. Because actually what you didn't see was the security infrastructure behind it, which enabled liberty. And the point of security in a free state like ours is to enable liberty, is not to enable control. And so depending on how you think about security, I think you can get a different result. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, security is about making sure you can have as much privacy, as much security to do the things that you want to do, to live the life that you want to live, start the business, to, you know, spend your time with the friends and family or whoever you want to spend in the environment you wish to spend it. And having that freedom is what security is about. It's about creating that envelope that allows you.
And talking of that, do you think there's a danger that we've spent so much time worrying about Islamic terrorism that we've kind of not paid enough attention to the threat of far-right terrorism? Do you think we've slightly sort of erred too far in one direction in the past?
So I don't buy that. And the reason I don't buy that is because, you know, one of my first friends in politics was Joe Cox, mm-hmm. who you'll remember was murdered by a far-right terrorist in 2016. And a lot of us have been very aware of the threat of the far-right and for historic family reasons. I have mm-hmm. been, and no doubt you have been aware of it in the past as well, too. But the reality is, sadly, that the challenge of Islamist violence in the UK has been real and rather larger than many people would like. I mean, one of my very, very oldest friends, a very close friend, was an imam who joined British Army as an imam. And when I asked him why he was doing it, he was quite clear. He said, it's not your kid who's going to be radicalized to join some jihadi group and go and kill themselves in some far-off land. It's mine. And remembering that Islamist, you know, the principal victims of the Islamist yeah. violence is the Muslim community itself, is why I think, one of the reasons why I think we've got to take this extremely seriously. And I don't think we're overstating it to say, I'm afraid this is the reality of the situation we face. It is.
And I don't want to sort of force you to sort of tread on other people's turf here, but do you think we have the tools we need to deal with online radicalization?
I mean, it's constantly evolving, is the answer. And so we have some phenomenally good people doing some pretty extraordinary work in ways that I'm afraid I'm not going to tell you about.
No, fair enough.
But some really, really impressive individuals doing some fantastically innovative stuff and changing the way that we understand risk and making sure that we see the threats as they arise. But you know, this is a race, and as we get better, so do others. And you know the old line about they only have to get lucky once. You know, and we need to be constantly on top of our game. And you know, we're very lucky. We have some extraordinarily dedicated individuals who work extraordinarily hard for our intelligence and security services in various different ways to keep us safe. And we are very, very lucky.
And should we have confidence in the Met Police as being the organisation responsible for counterterrorism, given all we've seen and heard of late?
So I work very closely with the counterterrorist police, and my answer to that is yes. They are a phenomenal force. Now, I'm not going to in any way go against the Casey Review. I think she made her points extremely clearly and extremely powerfully, and I think she's right. There are cultural issues that we frankly have to deal with now. It's not going to surprise you to hear that we've been having loads of conversations about that in the Home Office, and that's one of the issues that we've been working on very closely. But the reality is that the counter-terrorist police is a large organisation that includes police officers around the country, and they do an extraordinary job. And one of the successes you can see, thank God, is the lack of dramatic incidents too often, if you like. I mean, well, once is too often, but you know what I mean? They're not as frequent as they might be, and that's not for lack of effort.
Because intuitively, I sort of think, well, if they're spending as much time and effort as they are on weeding out problems inside their own ranks, that surely has to have an impact on their ability to do their day job. And am I just misunderstanding?
No, they take their internal ethos extremely seriously, and they take it seriously because they realise that they police with the confidence and the trust of the British people. So, you know, this is not, you know, I can tell you, speaking to the people who run the CTP, they take this extremely seriously. And the new Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police has been extremely clear on the standards he expects from all of his officers. And as you know, he's already begun various processes in changing the way in which policing works in the UK. And I think that's really important. But I think, you know, the key of this is you look at the result, and the extraordinary security which we're able to enjoy here is not accidental. You know, we don't have armed police on every street mm-hmm. corner. We don't have the sort of heavy-handed police actions that sadly some countries have got used to. It's not to say that we don't have armed police around. We do. They're available. But a lot of it is intelligence-led. And what the counter-terrorist police have demonstrated in the UK is you can have very judicious action when it is connected to other agencies, to other groups, to very good community engagement. And that's one of the things they do.
Okay. Turning to sort of broader foreign and security policy, I suppose the first obvious question is, what did you make of the refresh of the integrated review?
Yeah, I was very supportive, actually. I mean, it's, you don't have to be a sage to, you don't have to be Kissinger to see that the world has changed in the last sort of 12, 24 months.
Yeah.
The war in Ukraine is pretty striking. And the reality of the challenge from China has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the refresh was very good. I thought, John Bew, who's an academic here, actually, mm-hmm. who was instrumental in writing that, did a phenomenal piece of work in bringing it up to date and making sure that those areas where we needed challenge, where we needed to think harder about things, were brought up to date. And one of those was in technology. One of the things that has been slightly overlooked, but is at the back of the document, is talking about an open source intelligence hub and the different ways in which we need to think about intelligence, as well as sort of, if you like, the physical geopolitics of the world.
Did the refresh impact on your role? In what way?
I just mentioned the open source intelligence hub, but it impacts on my role in the way in which we think about other elements of security. So here in the UK, one of the things that we spend a huge amount of effort in defending is our democracy, our mm-hmm. democratic system. And foreign influence, I'm afraid, is rather more frequent than we would like, and there are threats to it. Now, actually, there are various different reasons we take a very active, various different ways we take a very active involvement in making sure we defend our democracy. And as you know, we've set up a new task force to do just that, mm-hmm. which I chair. And this Prime Minister has given resource to enable us to do even more. So there's a lot going on. In fact, we've just set up a new election security unit. It used to be set up just before an election for a period and then disappear again. And we've just established one that's going to set up and stay, if you like, and be enduring. And the reason we've done that is because the attempt to influence our politics is sadly growing, and not only from the places you'd imagine, but also from some others. And I think that's one of those areas where, the review talks about that and goes into various areas of that, and so that's made a difference. I wouldn't want to overstate it, by the way, but we're, we're aware.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you think we've got the balance right when it comes to China now? It's a difficult balancing act, because China's a far harder adversary than the Soviet Union was, because they're an economic challenger as well.
Yeah, look, the Soviet challenge was, as you rightly say, very different. It was different not just because it was, as you rightly say, not so much of an economic challenge, but it was also self-contained. We didn't have the same connections. The UK's connection to the Soviet Union economically was a little bit of energy and a little bit of gold trading. That was it. And the gold was bullion that was being stored, really, more than anything else.
And there was never an alternative model, because you just had to look and see.
Right, exactly. In the 60s and 70s, that wasn't quite so obvious. And indeed, some people maintained that idea way up until the late 80s, as you know.
Or indeed now.
One or two people who still maintain it. But it was very different. The difference, of course, is China is much more integrated into the global economy, into our economy. I look at your iPad there and your phone. If not most of, certainly a large proportion of the components that are sitting on that table were made in China, including possibly the paper and the pens and maybe even the glasses. So, it's a huge amount of the connection makes that a very different relationship. And it makes the challenge very real, because what we've got to realize is that what China is actually offering is a level of risk into our own lives that we haven't fully appreciated. And that's not because I say the CCP is trying to invade or occupy or anything. There's nothing like that. It's because the Chinese model is fundamentally based on central control.
Mm-hmm.
It's fundamentally based on The emperor or the president sits in Beijing and runs the country and runs the dependencies from there. And you see this in the economic models, you see this in the level of connections. Now, I know that the different provinces have huge amounts of autonomy. What's the line? The mountain is high and the emperor is far away or something. It's certainly true that China isn't a single unitary state in that sense. It does have huge divergence. But it attempts a level of centralization, even if it doesn't succeed. But we don't. And what that does is it's attempting to replace that extraordinary architecture that we built up in the last 70, 80 years, the rule of law, the international rules-based system, as it's sometimes called. But basically, the predictability of an agreed set of rules, an algorithm, if you like, for running things that we agree together. It's trying to swap that for a rule of force, a much greater dependency on a single power, in this case, Beijing. Now, whether you think China's good or bad is irrelevant to the reality that just injects risk. One of the hardest things in any society is the peaceful transfer of power. Yeah. It's just really difficult to do.
Yeah.
The whole of Shakespeare is about the failure of this country to achieve a peaceful transfer of power. Yeah. The whole of, most of history is about that failure. And finally, we've got to a position where we are successfully transferring power, not just internally peacefully through democracy, but we're actually transferring power externally peacefully as nations rise and fall on agreed norms. Britain has changed its position relative to others in the last 70 or 80 years. The United States has, France has, Germany has, and so on. All of these positions have changed, but they've changed peacefully. That's really difficult to achieve, and it only works if you set out agreed norms in advance and you follow them. And that's what we call the rule of law. What China's doing is not that. What it's trying to do is to change based on fealty, obedience, and power.
But emerging hegemons always do that, don't they? They always look at the rules that existed and say, actually, we didn't write those, we're going to write our own. I mean, it's not new.
It's not new, but it doesn't make it...
No.
It doesn't make it easier. And, you say China didn't write them. Actually, China was instrumental in writing the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Chinese diplomats were very much part of it, and it was hugely influenced by Confucian thought. So, the UN is influenced by, very strongly influenced by China. As you know, China was the first country to sign the UN Declaration.
I mean, on a linked theme, when we come to talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, one of the most striking things has been the apparent reluctance of many non-aligned or emerging powers to sort of side with the West on this. And part, there are lots of reasons for this. Part of it is sort of long-standing resentments. Do you think that's something we should be profoundly concerned about?
It's something we should be absolutely aware of. I mean, it's quite striking to me that today the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, declared his intention to withdraw from the International Criminal Court, citing the indictment of Putin as one of the, as the trigger. Whether it's the main reason or not, I don't know, but it's certainly he cited it. And it's certainly an interesting observation that there are many people around the world who don't feel that this is, this is working for them. And that's where, nobody argues that we don't need reform of the international rules-based system. Nobody argues that we don't need reform of the WTO or reform of the UN or reform of the many bodies that go into it. But the reform that we should be looking for is the same as, the same as the way that we should be looking at society at home. We want to give voices to many. We don't want to be centralizing on a few. And what we're seeing in the way that some countries operate is they're seeking that singular authority rather than a distributed network.
Yeah. Let's not start on Modi. I'll never get another visa as long as I live. But how much of a game changer do you think Finnish and potentially Swedish membership of NATO is, or is it just symbolic?
On one level, it's not a huge change. I mean, Finland has been interoperable militarily with NATO for many years, as has Sweden. And, so on one level, maybe it doesn't appear to be a lot. But let's be quite clear. The very fact that Finland and Sweden, two countries that have prided themselves on their neutrality for almost a century, have decided to take this decision, really tells you that those who are closest to the bear know that when it growls, it means it. And they're absolutely serious And they're worried, and they're right to be. So I think it's pretty telling. I mean, it's, you know, I always hate the line, you know, NATO is expanding east. NATO isn't doing anything. NATO is sitting in Brussels, writing various agreements and treaties. NATO hasn't planned to go east or west or north or south. NATO doesn't have that kind of a plan. Countries that are closest to the east, countries that are most fearful of Russia, are gripping tighter to their partners around. This strikes me as a perfectly reasonable thing. That's not expansion, that's defence.
Which I suppose brings us to the question of Ukraine and NATO. Are you concerned? I mean, I'm certainly concerned that some countries in the West are making hints, if not promises, that they have no intention of keeping to the Ukrainians when it comes to either NATO or indeed EU membership. How do you see the question of Ukrainian NATO membership?
So the first thing we've got to do is win the war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And let me be quite clear what I mean by that. I mean the Ukrainians, the Ukrainian people and their sovereign government need to be in a position to negotiate the future that they wish to see. Now, it's not for me to define that, but it's for them to define it. And I hope very much that that they will be in that position very soon, because every day that goes by are more lives lost, not just Ukrainian, of course, Russian as well. And the Russians who've been badly misled by Putin are paying with their lives. And so if you have any sympathy for the Russian people, hoping for Russia to withdraw from its occupation is something we should be all hoping for. But I hope that the future of Ukraine, whatever future the Ukrainian people choose, is something we'll be able to discuss as free and sovereign peoples.
But to go back to the question, are you concerned about the prospect of Ukrainian NATO membership, or do you think it's something that's...
It's too far in the future for me to express a view on it, frankly. I mean, I think that it's unquestionable that Ukraine mm-hmm. will require security guarantees. The question is what those security guarantees will look like. Will depend on the position that we find ourselves in when Ukraine has expelled Russian occupation. And it'll depend on the state of Russia, you know, what state Putin has left it in, before we can judge that.
Post Salisbury, do you think we're better placed to counter Russian attempts at interference in our country than we were?
Yes, unquestionably. Look, post Salisbury, I mean, a huge amount of things changed around the time of Salisbury. And it's, you know, when I was first elected chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, one of the first reports that we did was on dirty money in the UK. We call it Moscow's gold. We published it in 2018, and it's something that I've been pretty vocal on for a long time. Really impressive writers like Oliver Bulow and Tom Keating and many others have been writing about this as well. Luke Harding has been exceptional. But that realization that dirty money is not just, you know, foreign corruption that's coming here and, hey, too bad for them, they should have guarded it better, but is actually a security threat to us, mm-hmm. Is a realization that I think has changed remarkably in the last 5-6 years. And, you know, the Salisbury attack was one of those moments that brought it to the fore. I mean, let's not forget, that wasn't the first time. In the attack on Litvinenko that murdered Litvinenko, the Russian state used a nuclear chemical that was so toxic that an airliner had to be taken out of service and various floors of a hotel had to be closed before they were able to be decontaminated and used again.
That's egregious.
It put hundreds and thousands of lives at risk. And then the chemical that was used against the Skripals, Novichok, you know, so poisonous that had it got into the water system, could have killed thousands. This is reckless to an extraordinary degree. And, you know, it's not an act of war. It's certainly a warlike act to be using chemical weapons in other people's countries like that. It's extraordinary.
I mean, a lot was said about dirty money. Do you think we've done enough about it here in London and indeed in our overseas territories?
There's a lot we're doing. We've just introduced the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Bill. We're introducing beneficial ownership registers. We're doing a huge amount about the duty to prevent fraud. And there's a whole series of areas we're going down. And actually working with Kevin Hollingrake on this has been a great pleasure, because he and I worked together with Margaret Hodge and people like Chris Bryant on this when we were backbenchers. And so to be able to deliver quite a lot of this is a great pleasure. Now, you know, is there further to go? Yes, and that's exactly what we're working on. And there's always, you know, the problem is every time we think we've closed off a loophole, another one is found, and we've got to keep working our way around. So it's not, sadly, it's not one of those things that are going to be quite finished, if you like, but we've made a huge difference, and the bills that are coming through are going to make a further difference.
Okay. Well, I've got to ask you this, because there are so many armchair generals about, but I mean, as a former soldier, when you look at the conflict in Ukraine, do you really think it is possible that they might succeed in driving the Russians out?
Yes.
Given the problems they
Absolutely.
Face, not least the problems
with... Yeah, I mean, look, the Russian army is very large. Let's not kid ourselves. This is a very large military that has a call on huge amounts of resources. But this is also an army that is riddled with corruption, that has turned to its prisons in order to mobilize people, mm-hmm. and that is, frankly, using its people as cannon fodder in the most brutal way. And what the Ukrainians have demonstrated in the last, well, not just in the last year, actually, but in the years running up to it, is that with the help of training, a lot of it from the British military, but also others like the Canadians, it's able to adapt, it's able to rethink the way it fights. And as you know, it's not, armies don't go to war, nations do. And the whole of the Ukrainian nation is at war, understands exactly what it's doing, what it's resisting and why it's fighting. You just have to look at the murders in Irpin and Bucha mm-hmm. to see why the Ukrainians are so determined to keep fighting. On the other side, you've got a dictator who has stolen literally hundreds of billions of dollars off his own people, has left them in squalor and in penury, and is now sending them to die in a meat grinder in southern Ukraine. I mean, it's absolutely horrific what Putin is doing to that country. I mean, it's the most brutal murder of his own people that we've seen in decades.
But you remain confident that the Ukrainians can actually win
Yes.
the conflict?
I mean, you know, this is something that we've got to be part of. And, you know, I'm hugely encouraged what Rishi's been saying. I mean, you know, the Prime Minister has maintained a very close connection to President Zelensky and has been mm-hmm. absolutely key to making sure that relationship is strengthened. And he's been extremely important in making sure that our allies, you know, live up to their commitments just as much as we do. And so I'm very confident.
I mean, you've painted a picture of quite a dangerous and unstable world that we're living. Do you think we're just going to have to get used to the idea of Cold War levels of military spending going forward and find a way of doing that?
So I think the way in which the world has changed means that we have to think about it differently. I'd be cautious about saying that it's Cold War levels of military spending, because this isn't the Cold War. Mm. It's not steel on steel in, you know, waiting for the Russians to come through or the Soviets to come through the Fulda Gap.
Yeah.
This is a much more integrated, much more challenging environment. And that's why, you know, the work that I'm doing is extremely challenging. Because this isn't, you know, I'm just... 40, 50 years ago, MI5 followed Russian spies around London. I mean, they did a lot more than that, but you know what I mean? That, that's a terribly crude simplification, but it's, you know, now the work that they're doing is exceptionally complicated and resulted in us setting up things like the National Protective Security Agency only a few weeks ago, in the Integrated Review, in which we're offering to business the kind of integrated protection that we'd formerly only done through GCHQ and the National Cybersecurity Center. So that sort of, that different way about thinking about security is the way I would be looking at this, rather than thinking about it as sort of, you know, waiting for tanks to cross the line.
No, but it's still expensive, isn't it? In the sense that we have to invest in our security at appropriate levels.
It's not cheap, but it's not just government spending. And this comes back to, it. You know, the society is not the same thing as the state. You know, the state clearly has a role. GCHQ is enormously important. And the work that our people do in Cheltenham is fantastic and hugely impressive. But actually the work that Google and Facebook and or rather Meta and Microsoft do, the work that many tiny companies that many of us have never heard of are doing in terms of cybersecurity, in terms of protecting our economy, are incredibly important. This is a much more whole of society effort than you know, just buying steel off someone and turning it into a tank.
I mean, one of the things about the integrated review that struck a lot of observers was that the EU figured a lot more in the refresh than it did in the original document. Do you want to see us sign some kind of formal security agreement with the European Union? Would that help us in any way?
Well, we already have. It's called NATO.
Right. But a bilateral between the UK and the European Union?
I mean, the EU isn't a defence provider in that sense. It isn't, you know, even France and Germany, you know, they have a military relationship through the EU, but their principal military relationship is through NATO. You know, it's, and they're, you know, they're very much at the heart of it. So, and when you talk to countries like Poland, they're very clear what they want. They want more investment in NATO. So, you know, I mean, I think you can dress it up in different ways, but I think that the relationship that we have with our European partners through NATO is enormously important, not just to them, but to us. And it offers an opportunity to have a much greater level of cooperation than I think many people often realise. You know, that alliance hasn't wavered, hasn't faltered, even in, you know, there may have been a few cross words in the last few years, but in that bit of Brussels, in Mons rather than in the building, you know, in the EU, it's been fine.
But I think, you know, if you go into the centre of Brussels, if you go to Schuman, they might not say that they're a security alliance, but they would a defence alliance, but they would say they are security providers in many of the fields that you're portfolio touches on, whether it is data or policing or dealing with radicalization. So in those areas...
Right, and we have conversations with them. I mean, you know, the EU is an important partner, and the EU is an important partner, and member states are important partners separately. And you know, both can be true. In fact, both are true. And the reason both are true is because, you're right, the various member states decide to pool certain areas of their competence and not others. You know, Frontex, for example, is an organisation that we are working with now and is an important part of keeping our own borders safe. It's effectively, it's enabling us to push our own borders hundreds of miles south and east, and cooperation with them really matters. And there are various other ways in which we are working with other elements of the European Union, but it's also true that we're working very closely with individual member states. And you know, we have an extraordinarily close relationship with France through the Combined Joint Expeditionary Force and indeed many other areas of cooperation. And we have an increasingly close cooperation with countries like Poland in Eastern Europe, who are, you know, going from being consumers to exporters, if you like, of security and defence.
And do you think the successful, well, apparently successful resolution of the standoff over the protocol is going to make all those conversations easier? Do you find...
Yeah, of course it is. And, you know, Rishi's achievement in doing that is, you know, should be appreciated. I mean, what he's done is he's enabled us to move that conversation on to park some of the bits that were causing an obstacle and enabled us to have different conversations. You know, it does get rather boring when you have the same chat the whole time with the same person.
I mean, don't answer this if you don't want to, but is it easier now to be a formally remain backing conservative in the party than it has been a period since 2016?
I've never really struggled with it. I mean, you know my view. It's not a secret. I voted Remain, but British people didn't. And if you're a Democrat, you know, the orders start somewhere, and they don't start with me. They start with the British people, and you know, I don't think it's a I don't think it's reasonable to keep going back and asking for a new set of orders.
Okay. You touched on your time as chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, and one of the most blistering reports you produced was about the evacuation from Afghanistan. Looking at what's happening now and at the headlines coming out of Khartoum, do you think we've learned lessons?
Well, look, I'd certainly see the reaction has been, the military reaction has been extremely impressive. You know, that response that we saw in those early, you know, in those early hours over the weekend, that saw members of the armed forces deploying to unknown airfields and onto the ground in Khartoum, It was extremely impressive. I mean, I know Khartoum. It's not an easy city in peace days, let alone what it must be like today. And it's a remarkable place. So I've been enormously impressed by what they've done, and you know, the border force officers who've gone with them to help enable the evacuation has demonstrated that integration that didn't happen before Kabul. So lessons have definitely been learned, and it's really impressive to see the military operating in that way.
Excellent. Now, I know you're on a tight timetable, so I don't want to over... I hope your watch is set 5 minutes fast.
It is, yeah.
All right, okay, good.
Sorry, that's an old habit.
We're going to end on a very scientific note, because we have formulated...
Oh.
The best minds have formulated a new elite quiz to figure out where you stand on one of the great...
I don't have a blue tick, so does that...
Who does? Who does?
Who does?
It's a very sore point. So I'm going to ask you a load of quick-fire questions, and when we've figured out what AI is, we'll run it through a program and tell you what the answer is. So, BBC or Netflix?
Oh, Amazon Prime, I'm afraid. I like Clarkson's Farm.
All right. Guardian or GB News?
I think they're both...
Well, they are slightly loaded, yes.
I think they're both pretty negative, actually. No, I think they're both pretty negative. I mean, The Guardian keeps telling me that I should hate Britain, and GB News tells me the best days are behind me. I don't believe either of those are true. I love Britain, and I think the best days are ahead of us.
OK, you're pretty much on null point so far.
Sorry,
I have to say. US or EU?
Oh, you're asking me to choose between my wife and my brother.
How there we go. All right, fair enough. Prince Harry or Piers Morgan?
Prince Harry. Look, Prince Harry, whatever you think of him, Prince Harry served us in combat, and I can tell you I served alongside him, and he was not treated any differently from anybody else until people worked out who he was, and then selfies came out. But he was lucky, actually. Most people didn't have that. Well, in fact, nobody had their phones with them in Helmand, so there was not that many photos. But he was incredibly courageous, and he served with distinction. And since he's left, the Invictus Games has changed the lives of, you know, thousands of veterans around the world, and I think that's, you know, I'll always be grateful to him for that.
Okay. Now I'm going to judge you on this one. Greggs or Pret?
Greggs. Definitely Greggs.
Right, fair enough.
Never shy of a sausage roll, and they've got a fantastic employment model.
Just saying sausage roll makes me hungry. Hotel or Airbnb?
Hotel. I'm a sucker for a minibar.
No, that's fine. I'm with you. Tofu or sausages? There's only one answer there.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I know. Okay, good. Ooh, levelling up or cutting taxes? You can pass on that one if it's...
No, it's got to be both. It's got to be both. How do you level up if you don't empower people to have more control of their lives? Come on.
Okay, that was a good shimmy. Bike or car?
You'll understand at the moment it's definitely bike.
Okay. Beer or wine?
Beer. Larkins from
Chillingston. Pounds and ounces, kilos and grams?
I can't do pounds and ounces. Kilos and grams.
Good for you. Maths or English?
Both. Again, oh, I mean, how the hell do you do logic if you can't explain
it? And
how
responsibility there? Surely.
Oh, well, sorry. look, I mean, you know, you've got to be able to talk to you. You've got to be able to communicate, and you've got to be able to understand, and you need both. You just do.
Football or rugby?
I'm not much of a team sport person, I'm afraid.
Twitter or TikTok?
Oh, God, not TikTok.
Okay.
I mean, cash, whatever Twitter's called.
Cash or contactless?
Contactless.
And this last one is just silly. Roads must fall or more new roads?
Fixing potholes is a big obsession of mine.
Okay, you pass.
Thank you.
In return for which, I'm going to give you this very, very treasured little present.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's not ticking.
I know you've got an incredible... No, it doesn't tick. Do you need to get it checked or something?
I'll probably have to get it swept. You know the story of the old the Russian ambassador who was given a gift by Russian school... Sorry, the American ambassador in Moscow who was given a gift by Russian school children.
No.
He was given a wooden emblem of the United States, and they scanned it and couldn't find anything with it, so they put it up on his wall. And for years, the Russians were spying on the Americans from this wooden thing because it had one of the world's first RFIDs. And what the Russians were doing is they were firing microwave energy at it to get this little thing to vibrate or to pick up the vibrations that people talking in the ambassador's room were making. Right. And so they were spying on the American embassy from the ambassador's office, from this kid's gift. What they were also doing, and this tells you a lot about the Soviet period and may explain why the cavalier attitude of the GRU and Litvinenko and Skripals is not so out of character. They gave leukemia to hundreds of US diplomats over years and years and years.
That has been washed clean. Tom, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank
Cheers.
You very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. It's nice to see you.
Good to see you as well.